Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
G'day, you're listening to 91.2 FM Haggerty Radio, Lamont. I'm Richard Crail, Crailsy to my mates, which, if you're listening to this, is you. And while I know it's hard to tell, I'm an Australian. I know the accent is so subtle and my mangling of various surnames and both the French and English languages is completely unnoticeable, but it is true. And this, the centenary celebrations of the iconic 24 Hours, is my first Le Mans. It's my first time to France. It's my first time to the Circuit de la Sarthe, and it's my first time here on air with Haggerty Radio Le Mans. So how does a fat kid from South Australian countryside end up at the world's biggest race? What on earth do I make of it? Does anyone really care what I think? Probably not, but you're going to find out anyway. I'll give my impressions on the week so far coming up, the trip here, the experience on arriving to the circuit for the first time, thoughts on test day, and some of the reasons why this event is so significant to me, but also more broadly to Australian motorsport fans. I'm also going to go and catch up with some of my Aussie mates in the paddock, and while Le Mans is iconic worldwide, it's got a mythical status in Australia too. Famous Aussies have raced here, less famous Aussies have worked here behind the scenes, and as it is in the rest of the world, this place is one of the big must-do events for us. With the slightest bent to enjoy motorsport, you've just got to be here. But before boring you to tears with my own story, it's probably worth telling you a bit about why this race is so special to me, but also to the rest of Australia. So while this year is the 100th anniversary of the first 24-hour race, it's the 95th of the first time an Aussie actually won it. That man was Bernard Reuben, a Melbourneian born in 1896, the son of a pearl salesman. After his family moved from Melbourne to London in the early 1900s, Reuben fought for the Royal Artillery in World War I and was badly injured in the process and sent back to his home in London. It was his friendship, however, forged with Wolf Bonato, the famed boss of Bentley, who led the way in the iconic Bentley Boys era at La Sarthe, that saw him become a racing driver. Reuben and Bonato were mates and drove a 4.5-litre blower Bentley the 1928 race, and they narrowly won, despite a holed radiator and being forced to limp the car home. Bernard was the first Aussie to compete, and indeed to win at Le Mans. And since then, remarkably, there's been just 39 other drivers to have joined that elite club of those racing at this place from down under, and fewer have managed to win it. Reuben's win was incredible, but for a long time it vanished from the record books. He lived in London, he raced for Bentley for a long time. People thought he was from the UK, but his chapter in the Australian motorsport history is very significant. Since him, there's been some remarkable stories. In Australia, Vern Schuppan should be one of the biggest motorsport heroes there is, but because he spent most of his career in sports cars, a niche sport to those down under, and even more so here at Le Mans, it's really only the hardcore fans who know of his achievements. And yet his success here at this place puts him among not just the greatest Aussie racing exploits, but among the best that's ever been at this place. Third in 1973, second in 1977, and again in 1981, this time with Hurley Haywood and Jochen Mass in a Porsche 936. He was second once again on the debut of the 956 a year later, but it was in 1983 where it all came together for our man Vern. Driving with Haywood and the great Al Holbert, Schuppan's Rothmans 956 was walking wounded at the end of the day and limped his car home with serious engine damage following race-long overheating issues. It's a remarkable synergy to how Bernard Reuben won with his holed radiator in that Bentley all those years earlier. Schuppan's engine seized on the final lap of the race, and with the field mowing him down, he was miraculously able to refire that engine, says something about the famed Porsche reliability, and limp his car across the line. As I said before, at the time few people knew of Bernard Reuben's success some 60 years earlier. Many at home hailed Vern as the first Aussie winner of the iconic 24-hour race, and it certainly put him, but also the race, on the map back home. With a win and five other podium finishes, he's absolutely the most successful Aussie in the race, and one of the most successful of all time. And Vern's also one of my personal racing heroes. He hails from a small mining town called Whyalla, which is about 4 hours north of the city of Adelaide in my home state of South Australia. Like me, he was a country kid with dreams of having a shot at the motorsport world, but at the time, with no real means to make it happen. He made it, though. He got here, and he made it work, and he won the race. And in some ways, I feel a synergy with that, with this event this weekend being a big box to tick in my own broadcasting career to join the Hagerty Radio Le Mans team. Vern's happy out of the limelight, quietly spoken, rarely appears for any public events, and definitely doesn't like the fanfare. But when you get the chance to converse with this all-time great of both Aussie motorsport and the Le Mans 24 Hour, irrespective of his nationality, it's captivating and inspirational, and his stories are as good as anybody who's come to this place. And Vern's Aussie success went a long way to making this race as recognised as it is down under. My own personal connection to Le Mans and the 24-hour race comes a year later, in 1984. As well as being the year I was born, unfortunate for some, good for me, it was the year when the Aussie invasion to France was at its peak. No less than 7 Aussies in the race that year, just 10 days after I was born. Several of them are among my all-time racing heroes, and the story of 84 is a remarkable one for Australian motorsport. 2 of them were household names, already Aussie sporting heroes, and go beyond motorsport in terms of their recognition. Another was a defending Le Mans winner in Vern Schuppan, while 2 others were among the greatest exponents of Australian touring car racing, both of them already Bathurst legends, and one of them already a 2-time winner at the time. Firstly, there was Alan Jones, the 1980 F1 world champion with Williams, Australia's 2nd after the great Sir Jack Brabham, who also raced here at Le Mans. Unlike Brabham before him, Jones came to Le Mans following his Formula One peak as he searched for the next phase of his racing life, which ultimately would end up in touring cars. Jones was paired in an all-star combination, driving for Kramer Racing in a Porsche 956B with defending winner Vern Schuppan and French Le Mans expert Jean-Pierre Jarret. Jones' Le Mans debut was successful. They finished 6th outright, as Porsche swept famously the top 7 places and 8 of the top 10, with the crushingly dominated 956, leading to that iconic poster where Porsche filled most of the top 10 positions. Also driving a Kramer Porsche that year was Victorian privateer and sand mining magnate Rusty French. Though first and foremost successful in business through his business Sky Sands, French was a notable touring car and GT racer throughout the 70s, 80s and 90s, and still in his 70s still races today, where he doubles as a co-owner of V8 supercar team Tickford Racing. French's most notable success came in 83 when he won the Aussie GT Championship in a Porsche 935, finishing 2nd to Alan Jones the year prior. This guy could steer. It was those Porsche links as well that brought the great Alan Grice to Le Mans in 1984 with Kramer Racing. His drive was a reward for his Australian GT success. But Rusty French drove with the famous Tiff Nadell, now a TV presenter, and opposite lock aficionado, and David Sutherland, and they completed 321 laps and finished a highly respectable 9th outright. Grice was a little bit further back, the iconic Aussie touring car privateer who bought an Aussie Holden Commodore to the World Touring Car Championship race at Spa and not only beat a lot of the international touring car teams, but the factory Holden dealer team at the time. He ran through the night, but unfortunately was out after 274 laps late in that race. Later, Gricey would become a member for Parliament in the state of Queensland. Maybe those motor racing politics worked well. He'd come back, actually, racing a Nissan R88C as part of a World Sports Car Championship campaign in 1988. And then there's Peter Brock and Larry Perkins, 2 of my all-time racing greats and familiar names to everybody in Australia, but probably most people listening to this around the world for their exploits at Mount Panorama. with all the heraldry that came from being the most famous name in Aussie motorsport, the all-star combination paired with then current Bathurst champions and another iconic touring car hero in Bob Jayne, who'd fund the enterprise via his massive tyre empire. The Bathurst links continued behind the scenes. John Fitzpatrick Racing was secured to prepare and run the Porsche 956 that Brock and Perkins would drive that year and that Jayne had leased. Though he was a Brit, Fitzpatrick actually has deep links to Bathurst. He won the 1000 in 1976, sharing a Holden Turana with Bob Morris in what was an emotional, dramatic victory for the privateers over the then-factory Holden team. The drivers weren't new to Le Mans either. Brock had first raced here in 1976, sharing a BMW CSL with fellow Aussie Brian Muir and Jean-Claude Albright, lasting 19 hours, before unfortunately failing to finish. He was entered in the 1981 race, remarkably sharing a Porsche 924 GT with his former Bathurst-winning co-pilot, the great Jim Richards, a New Zealander, and his former Holden dealer team teammate, Colin Bond. The car was entered by Porsche Cars Australia, remarkably, at that point run by their local importer, Alan Hamilton, himself a former racer. Though high profile and high quality, the team failed to qualify for the race and spent their weekend on the reserve list watching on. Perkins' Le Mans debut came between Brock's first start and the non-event of the 81 Porsche campaign, driving with Gordon Spice and Jean Roulon Miller in a Porsche 911 in 1978, just following his brief Formula One career. They finished 14th. 1984, however, as I said, was special. It was the big show for both, a chance for two of the greatest touring car drivers in Australia, backed by another, and in a car fielded by someone who got the Aussie way of going racing. To put it mildly, it was big news. All the elements were in place, and as the key protagonist explained, they worked particularly hard to get the whole thing together and to be competitive. And they were. Larry Perkins qualified the car 15th, but despite high fuel consumption and oppressive in-car heat, it forced a driver change at every pit stop, so the pair rotated every time the bright orange Porsche came into pit lane. Despite that, by the time the race reached the three-hour mark, they'd run in fifth position. Unfortunately, a wheel came loose with Brock behind the wheel just after 6:15 p.m. on Saturday evening. The limp home and subsequent repairs cost them 28 minutes, but in a 24-hour race, they remained in the game. A broken rear rocker arm then cost them a further 15 minutes later at 9 p.m., but the decision was taken to press on through the night in a bid to make up time. Remarkably, the team had hauled themselves back into the top 20 when Perkins found lap traffic in the S's just before 2 a.m. There was an off, the car ended in the catch fencing just beyond the famous Dunlop Bridge, and sadly, their race was over. They had, however, proven a point. Two touring car racers and an Aussie sponsor had come from the other side of the world and properly demonstrated their competitive intent, and it wouldn't be the last time. And for me, it's one of the amazing Aussie stories at this place, because it's a fish out of water syndrome, but they made it work, they were competitive, and they had a great time and put on a great show. You're listening to 91.2 Haggerty Radio Le Mans. I'm Richard Crail, and this is my first time here, and I'm having a ball and can't wait for the race to start. Also having a ball is one of the international Aussies racing here this year. His name is James Allen. No, not the TV commentator, the racing car driver. He's aboard the CrowdStrike Racing Orica in the LMP2 AM class, driving with George Kurtz and Colin Brown, with a car run by Algarve Pro Racing. James, for me, is an interesting subject because back home, few people know of him. He left early. He didn't race domestically at all, and to this day only has two or three car races on Aussie soil to his credit. And yet he's here as a professional driver, making a living from the sport, as you'll hear, living in the south of France, and racing in the most famous race in the world. I thought it's a great story. So I wandered down to CrowdStrike Racing, to their hospitality area, to find out a little bit more. And I wanted to get an Aussie's input on what makes this racetrack so special. It's my first trip to Le Mans, and what we wanted to do was grab a fellow Aussie to help explain the experience. So I've come to CrowdStrike Racing, and I found James Allen. Hello, mate.
Hey, mate. How you doing?
I'm good. Loving this. This is your sixth time here. Does it ever get old, this place?
No, it most certainly doesn't. It only gets more and more exciting, to be honest. This is such an amazing place and an amazing circuit. You always feel like you learn something new every time you come here, and it's really an amazing event.
You're the most raced international Aussie of late that doesn't have a massive profile back home, because you left really early, didn't you?
Yeah, as soon as I got out of karting, I went to Europe and went into the Formula BMW Talent Cup in 2013. And yeah, so I didn't have a huge amount of Australian following, even now. It was just because I was just never around. I even went back home to do a race in TCR Australia. And that was sort of my intro to Australian racing. And then I was meant to do another race the next year at the Asia Pacific Cup, which got cancelled due to COVID. So yeah, definitely not a huge presence in Australia at all.
So how many races would you say you've done on Aussie soil?
One, I didn't start, so I've done two.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
One, we had a technical issue, and yeah, the race didn't start, so I've done two races.
That's crazy. So what led you to the sports car path? What was it that brought you down this road in particular?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I've never wanted to do Formula One. I've just always been a fan of Le Mans prototypes, specifically sports car racing. I've just always been fascinated by the car itself. And I've always liked fast and exotic cars, and I've never really considered things like open wheelers. They're sort of, you can never really associate that with like a road car or anything like that. Whereas I think with sports cars you certainly can. That's the best explanation I've been able to come up with. I've just been fascinated with the cars ever since I was a little kid.
Boy from Perth, so this warm weather will be suiting you right now, as it is me.
Yeah, so it's a lot more humid than Perth for sure. But yeah, no, definitely I'm a lot more used to it than most other people are here, I think.
And where's home for you in this part of the world?
So I live in Antibes, just outside of Nice in France, during the year. And it's a bit like Perth. It's sort of that dry, warm kind of climate, and it's really lovely.
Yeah, seaside culture?
Yeah, exactly. Which is just like Perth, as I'm sure you know.
That's good. How did test day go for you guys?
Look, I mean, I think because I'm quite experienced here, the focus was mainly on George and Colin, because Colin's been here once and George hasn't actually done the 24 hours before at all. So definitely the main focus was them getting laps, them getting seat time and understanding the car and the track, especially since it is quite a bit different now between this car and the IMSA car. Mm. But yeah, it was just sort of feeling things out, making sure everything's running properly, and then we really start to push come Wednesday, Thursday.
The LMP2 situation here in terms of their performance has been well documented, but what are the differences and what's the feeling difference between this car and what you're racing in IMSA?
So, I mean, the big difference now is the aero kit. We have a specific aero kit for WEC that we used to only use for Le Mans, but now it's used for the entirety of the WEC. And that it provides a lot less drag, but also a lot less downforce, which George has said he feels, and Colin as well, feels a lot different between the two cars. And then the tyres. We have Goodyear tyres here that are mandated for every team, unlike the Michelin tyres, which we race in IMSA. The big difference has been the Michelin tyre tends to like a lot of combined loads, and you can trail the brakes in a lot more than you can with the Goodyear. So it's been a bit of a learning curve for both George and Colin, but they've adapted quite well.
And how quickly do you adapt, and what sort of role do you take in leading that with two guys that perhaps don't have quite that level of experience on this tyre and in this package?
I mean, I think they got to grips with it quite quickly. We had a test in Monza a couple of weeks ago. But I think the big thing here at Le Mans is more the overtaking GT cars as a prototype, and what to look out for with the GTPs and hypercars coming up behind us. I've been asked a few times about, like, you know, is this going to work? Can I go here to pass a GT? Or if I've got a GTP car coming up behind me at this section, do I let him pass? Do I stay in front of him? And I think that's really been the big thing this week.
Everyone I've asked about LMP2 says it's going to be a war. It is ultra competitive. There are 24 cars and a whole heap of them can win. Where do you feel like you guys are placed coming into it? I know it's impossible to get a read on performance and where your rivals are sitting, especially after a test day where we can't really draw too many conclusions. But, I mean, do you feel like you guys are in the mix?
I think so. I think for the Pro-Am category, we are definitely in the mix. It's always hard to tell at Le Mans. Like, the people who are fast in practice for even up to even qualifying, like, there's no... It's been a good while since I think I've seen an LMP2 pole sitter actually win the race. Mm. I don't think you can really get any sort of gauge where where everyone's at based on the pace in practice alone. I think you really have to wait, because also the conditions change between Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon. So the car could work very well Sunday afternoon and be way off on Sunday afternoon. So it's really, you honestly can't tell until you really wake up on Sunday morning, then you really get a good gauge. Cause, and then also, that's before you even take reliability into account.
Yeah.
I mean, the Gibson engine itself has been quite good, but we've had the occasional suspension failure we've seen on LMP2s in the past. Yeah, so it's pretty much impossible to tell.
Yeah. And you're in the Pro-Am race, as you said, but of course, when you get the AM driver time out of the way, you become a pro car. So you can play, you keep yourself within that lead lap or within a couple of laps of the lead, you can find yourself in an outright contention as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely, it's a lot more difficult than, say, IMSA racing in Daytona. But for sure, if you're in the lead lap going into the final sort of few hours, you're definitely in with a shot.
Now, it's my first time here. I've been fortunate to get around most of the track and have a look. And
well,
it's sensational. Well, what I'd like you to do, talk me around a lap, if you could, in an LMP2 car, starting at the start-finish line, obviously, and work your way around. And just tell me what the key bits are and walk me through a lap of this incredible place.
Okay, well, for sure, I mean, just to start out as a general point, Le Mans has obviously extraordinarily long straights everywhere. So exit speed is really, like, is king. Like, that's what you want to do for most of the corners you approach. Starting from the start-finish line, you've got the kink before Dunlop, and that's totally flat out in a P2, even now, especially now with the less power. Make sure you're perfectly straight before braking, because we've seen... You got the P-shirt, just in case.
John Hindoff is here, and he's just got the track map out to a guy who's been here 5 times before.
Yeah, absolutely. Most important thing for Dunlop is make sure you are absolutely straight before you hit the brakes, because we've seen so many years in the past, someone's turning, they jump on the brakes and the car snaps and goes straight into the right hand wall. From there, you want to make sure you're quite tight. So I've tried to explain it to Colin and George, like the second chicane at Monza, but a bit bigger.
Yep.
Where you want to go in fast, but you want to make sure you exit right all the way on the, like, mostly on the left, so you can be flat out through the second one, and then obviously stay within track limits, which is something that a lot of people have been getting done for the test yesterday. And then you're flat all the way down to the S's, again, making sure you're all the way on the right before turning in. You want to turn in quite early, because it's quite a large sort of banked part. But then you can, on the exit, you can use sort of, maybe leave a car width on the right before going through the next S, which is a lot more difficult, because not only is it off camber, you've got a crest at the end and then an off-camber curb, which, contrary to what it's supposed to do, tends to suck you off into the wall.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
suck
right.
You out into the wall. Rather
yeah,
than
suck yeah, yeah. No, it's well recovered.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. So, well done. So we're heading down to Tête Rouge.
Tête Rouge, honestly, quite a simple corner. It's you just need to be careful about track limits. Just a quick dab on the brakes, down to fourth. And then make sure early on the power to get onto the very long Mulsanne straight before your speed trap it in the first Mulsanne chicane.
And the straight, how much are you taking that opportunity to have a rest? We hear the engineers on the radio going, all right, mate, have a breath, take a moment. Is that what you're doing down there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a great... I mean, we're usually in the car for such long periods of time. It's really good for all four straights, really. The straights from Tête Rouge down to Mulsanne corner, and then even from Mulsanne down to Indianapolis, it is a very good opportunity to have a quick breather and just sort of gather your thoughts and also plan your next move if you're coming up behind someone as well.
Now, first chicane, Daytona chicane, as it is now.
To go with the Le Mans chicane and Daytona.
yeah, exactly right. Confusing for some. I imagine braking, absolutely critical there.
100%. Braking, and then sort of, you want to carry the speed into the first right as well, because that's a big point. You can't really prepare the right to... Well, prepare the left to by slowing down the right. You want to carry as much speed into the right as you can, stop for the left, and then get on the power as high as you can for the second right.
Mm. Mm.
And then the second chicane is basically the same corner but backwards, so the same philosophy, fast in, slow in the middle, fast out.
Are they the same corner reversed, or are there differences between them?
They're a little bit different. You approach the first chicane a bit quicker, so your braking points are a tad earlier than the second chicane, but for sure, once you get in, they are quite similar.
And then talk us about the run... The final part of the Mulsanne straight and down towards Mulsanne corner.
So you come out of the second chicane, and you just sort of, the racing line takes you all the way to the right before that little kink, and it's a good opportunity to make sure a hypercar's not bearing down on you and trying to find their way next to you. And then Mulsanne, quite quite straightforward, honestly. Like, it's a bit tough when you get there because it is blind. There's a little kink before the actual corner, so you do need to sort of get your bearings before you really try to attack there. But just quick, sharp turn in at the 100 meters to break just across the flat curb at the kink, and then go out as wide as you can. I noticed it looks like they've taken a little bit of tarmac out of the first part, and then a lot of tarmac on the exit. And yeah, just get the car turned early and get on the power as hard as you can, because you've got another massively long straight afterwards.
And a different character of straight to what we've experienced on that long run down from Tête Rouge all the way to Mulsanne, because it feels narrower, there's more trees around, and a bit more undulation and a bit more camber on the road as well, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're blind coming over the two kinks, and as well, you have to be careful when you're trying to pass a GT, because occasionally you get one that's not quite paying attention behind him, and he sort of goes to the apex while you're there, and the curbs on the inside of those kinks are very unfriendly as well. They can really unsettle the car and cause big problems. Fortunately, we're not taking off like they used to in the 90s, but...
Yeah.
We hope not.
I've seen, coming out of... Is it the second kink? There's, like, these trees. I've looked into the trees, and there's some that are, like, hit over. Are they just... Is that from that?
No, they've just fallen off, okay. I think. Yeah. Nobody's been in there recently.
Well, I just meant, like, maybe they just left it since they dug the murk out of there.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. Like, we can't replant the trees.
Yeah, true. Indianapolis.
Indianapolis is... For me, probably the most treacherous corner on the entire circuit.
Really?
Yeah, because all it takes is you to take that little bit too much speed into the kink, and you don't get slowed down for Indianapolis. You miss the banking, and you're straight in the gravel trap if you're lucky.
Yeah.
So, yeah, quick dab on the brakes just at the start of the AstroTurf going into the kink. A downshift makes it a lot easier. If you go into fifth, then you've just got less to do going into the actual Indianapolis corner.
Yeah.
Turn in right at the end of the curb. Make sure you catch that banking, and then... hard on the power, even though it's not really a very long straight. You do want to just get on it because there is so much grip with the banking.
Overtaking opportunity?
I did it once in 2017 on a GT, and I learned.
I see.
Not the best, no.
Keep walking us around to Arnage.
Arnage is the slowest corner on the circuit, and you really do feel it. You wouldn't think so with how Mulsanne is profiled, but Arnage is just a incredibly slow and low grip corner. It's quite tough, but it's narrower on the entry than it is on the exit, so it's deceptively an early apex. Yep. You just kind of want to cut across the curb, and then like you sort of carry speed across the curb, and then make sure you're hard on the power. But then you do have a whole lot of room on the exit, as long as you're not going onto the AstroTurf and onto the curb. You can get on it quite hard, and obviously be very careful of that wall that is conveniently placed right on the curb of the exit of the corner.
Now, the next section is extremely famous, as they all are, but I imagine in an LMP2 car on a slick tyre, laden with downforce, Porsche curves must be pretty decent to drive.
Yeah, I think Porsche, for every prototype driver, the Porsche curves are everyone's favourite. Are you, like, just a tiniest dab on the brakes into, like, when you cross the AstroTurf, down one gear, and then you're straight back on the power all the way through Porsche 2, 3, and then... another tiny break, and then downshift again to fourth. Roll as much speed as you can, and then you're back on the power, and you're flat through the last corner at karting.
Mm. Is it one of those corners where if you get the first bit wrong, it affects your momentum the whole way through?
For sure. If you're slow through the first one, you're slow through all of them, because you can't really change what you do once you've got through. Like, you are still going to have to break into Porsche 4. You're still going to have to downshift. So that little drop in momentum just carries all the way down through all of the corners, and it's... You feel like you've got it right, and then you've lost like half a second if you're not careful.
Yeah, and in a field this close, that's a big margin. So we're past the cutting track and then into that final chicane, which on paper looks so simple, but how many times have we seen people caught out by the Ford chicane?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't count the amount of people that have either missed the curb on the right or tried to overcommit and ended up in the motor wall on the left. But yeah, it's just you almost have to treat it like all four corners like one corner. You're sort of always, you've got one brake and then one application of power, so you're sort of braking quite hard and then rolling speed through the first two, and then you sort of have like another little brake just to get the gears down and prepare yourself for the last one. But you never get back on the gas. If you have to get back on the gas between the two, you've gone too slow through the first one. So you are just kind of feel like you're on the nose the whole time, and then if you've got it right, you're sort of trying to manage the car as best as you can just to be well placed for the last sort of chicane, and then you jump over the curb for the first left, for the second left, sorry, and then straight back hard on the power through the last corner and onto the main straight.
And hopefully to a checkered flag.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah. To the end of the race. That's a great description. Thank you. I've learned plenty there, and it's a long lap, but it's so complex and so many different elements. And if you get one part of it wrong, it can affect so much more of that lap, especially the straight and the Porsche curves. As you said, it's great to catch up with you. I wish you all the best of luck this weekend. There's not many of us here this year from Down Under. So it's you and Briscoe in the race, and that's about it.
Yeah, that is actually. I was surprised because I thought Matt Campbell was going to be driving the Porsche. It's a real shame that he's not here. But
so did he. Yeah.
I didn't know. Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to.
No, they might come knocking one day. You don't want to get involved in that. No, well done. You're flying the flag brilliantly, though, for those of us following your career back home. Congratulations and all the very best for the weekend.
Thank you so much.
That was Aussie James Allen. He's racing for CrowdStrike Racing, the Algarve Pro Run Orica Gibson in this year's LMP2 AM battle. And what a class that is going to be. The thing to remember about James is that when all the pros get in the car, those AM categorised LMP2s become outright contenders. So if they can buy themselves a ticket to the final stages of the race, they're every bit an outright contender. James is a fascinating story for us, mainly because he departed our shores early. He doesn't have a massive profile. In fact, at home, the former Formula One commentator is probably better known than James himself. But he's a great advert for Australian motorsport, and he's doing great things. We wish him all the best this weekend. In what is, it must be said, not a massive Aussie contingent tackling the 24-hour this year. Ryan Briscoe, of course, races for Scuderia Cameron Glickenhaus, and he should go okay. That car showed good pace early in the test day, and they've had a solid start to their FIA World Endurance Championship campaign. Looking forward to that. And then in the Porsche Penske Motorsport camp, Matt Campbell is a reserve driver. Missed out on the slot in the number 75 car, which is the third entry for that team this weekend, made up of their IMSA drivers. So Matt, in reserve duties, but not bad when you can rely on someone who's won the LMGTE class, a proven performer at this place in the past as your reserve driver. And Matt's opportunity in the outright class, like so many other Aussies in the past, will surely come. In the Road to Le Mans races, there's some Aussies featuring. George Nackis and Fraser Ross are on a Graf Racing Run Liège. Andreas Latour is driving for Inter Europol. And in the broadcast side of things, there's two of us calling the race this year. I'm fortunate enough to be part of Hagerty Radio Le Mans, while one of my commentary heroes, I suppose, Lee Diffie, will be making his return to La Sarthe this year, working for Eurosport. Diff called the race for Speed TV back in his days, before calling IndyCar for NBC, and it's going to be cool to have him back here this year, the first year I get to have a play at Le Mans as well. Speaking of broadcasters, before I made the trip to France, I wanted some advice, some opinions on what I could expect on my first Le Mans 24-hour. So I got in touch with my good friend and one of Australia's best-known broadcasters, Greg Rust. Rusty is a bit of a legend. He runs a great podcast, he's a brilliant host and an even better commentator. And he's been here before. He covered this race for Network 10 years ago. So I got Rusty on the line and asked him some questions about what I could expect and what his endearing memories of this place were as I made my first trip to Le Mans. Here's Aussie motorsport broadcaster Greg Rust chatting to me about his first Le Mans 24-hour experience.
I had been wanting to do it for years because my buddy Lee Diffie and a producer I'd worked with for many years, Tim Jardine, made some docos there in the late 90s for Channel 10. They were there when Mark Webber flipped in that very difficult year for Mercedes-Benz, for example. But it took me until 2015 to get there. And I was kind of semi-guest of the Webbers. And I was also there for carsales.com.au as a part of the Nissan contingent. So I got to be in the pit garage with the GTR LM Nismo. You remember the front-wheel drive car, and fellow Aussie Paul Ryan was involved in that project, and Nissan did it unbelievably well. So for me, it was a race I'd always wanted to go to, and it was like eyes wide open. I don't think I slept for 27 odd hours. In the middle of the night, they took us across to Indianapolis, you know, through the forest, so you could watch them coming through there. this is at the phase where I was able to see the 919 for the very first time, and they were like Scalextric's cars. They were like slot cars. They were unbelievable to watch. Got to do some very other cool things. I love the movie Le Mans with Steve McQueen. That is a real personal favourite of mine. For all its lack of dialogue, I got to sit in the restaurant on Mulsanne Street and have a pretty ordinary steak and be right beside the cars as they came by. So I got for a first time the full experience. And we were there with a couple of other journos, Gordon Lomas from Speed Cafe at the time, and more, and treated Richard a helicopter ride over the circuit so you could see the cars, and just blew me away how many people, you know, pre-pandemic go there and make a real thing of it, a real whole heaps of Brits and, you know, a couple of 100,000 people, and just an amazing, amazing atmosphere. It is a must do for any Aussie that properly loves their motorsport.
The event seems to have a unique appeal to Aussies in particular. Do you have any sort of thought about why that might be and why it's so special, not just from a racing car driver point of view, but for you and I, for journos, for broadcasters, and then for fans to travel all that way to go and see that race?
I think it's a couple of things. Firstly, the history of the race. I never did history in high school. I wish I did, and I have admired and learnt a lot on that side on motor racing. It's such an historically significant place in motorsport. The great Aussies that you're talking about here that have come through and raced there to finally go there and see that place. And I think by nature, we are gritty sports people, aren't we? We never give up. I mean, this is the ultimate test of grit and endurance. And you know, for me, I was whinging about being awake for more than 24 hours. It's nothing compared to being a competitor or a team member and what goes into it on that day/night, and let alone in the build up, mate. It's just an awesome thing to go and see.
Do you have a favourite Le Mans memory, whether it's from your trip or from watching the race as a fan, covering it as a journalist, a broadcaster over the years? Is there something that pops in your mind that you go, yeah, that was an incredible moment in sport? And it doesn't have to be Aussie related.
I got to cover it once for Network 10, but I felt very removed from it because it was just, you were just sort of hosting the feed coming through. So that's why it was so much better to actually go there and be a part of it. I think the years that my buddy Lee Diffie and Timmy Jardine and I think even John Smales was there at one, if not more of them, Rich. You know, there were so many manufacturers then, you know, some great battles, and it was in the emerging period of, I mean, we saw the Toyota in that phase, and then, you know, what came after that with Audi and what I got to see with Porsche. I mean, just the immensely powerful, intoxicatingly brutal race cars that they handled somehow around that place. And then to think that it's 13 odd Ks long, it's hard to, you know, say one. You know, I think of Ernst Schuppen and the Porsche, all sorts of things, mate, yeah, that come to mind.
And you mentioned Lee Diffie, who got to call David Brabham winning the race for Peugeot in 2009, which is a cool moment. And it strikes me as one of those events that, as a broadcaster, you look at and go, I'd love to have an opportunity at that race one day to call it and to have a crack at it. It's sort of a bucket list thing, isn't it?
That lucky maniac has done the triple crown that you and I sort of admire from a race driver perspective. He's got to do it from a commentary perspective. So to be on the ground for Monaco, to call Le Mans for many years at the venue, and he did a super job with that. And now what he's doing at Indy 500 and with the IndyCar Championship has sort of completed that circle. So, to see Aussies succeeding at that event, not just in behind the wheel of a race car, I reckon is immense.
And finally, what would you tell Australians who are perhaps on the fence, going, oh, do you know, I'd like to go to Le Mans, but I'd also like to do Monaco or Indy. What would you tell them to go and sway them perhaps towards going to the 24-hour? What would be the unique selling point that you go, yes, this is something you have to do?
The great example I could give you is my buddy Trevor Long, who is the gadget guy on the Today Show, and he loves his motor racing, but he probably would be the first to tell you that he's not a total guru, but he has followed it for many, many years. And he went there well before me. It was like a post high school trip that he just had to go and do. And I think he went to the British Grand Prix along the way and so on. And he to this day raves about it. So, you know, even if you're not a motor racing aficionado, but you love it, you must go. It's like us and why we love Bathurst. There are a handful of events and places around the world that are special and significant for different reasons. And Le Mans, for all the stuff we've talked about from its history and more, for me, it is a bucket list, Rich. You need to go and do it. See the cars, see them at night at the iconic parts of the circuit, go around to as many of them as you can and understand and appreciate why this is one of the ultimate quests of endurance in a motor racing sense.
As always, we appreciate your insight. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you, mate.
It's Crailsy here, and I'm at Le Mans for the first time. So in case you didn't know, it's a bloody long way from Adelaide, the great state of South Australia, to Le Mans. Getting here is not the work of the moment. From Adelaide, it's 3 hours on a Qantas 737 to Perth, the most remote capital city in the world. But fortunately, it's now within a one-shot, no-stop journey to Europe. From there, it's a Qantas Dreamliner, a 787, for the 16 hours and 45-minute flight direct to London Heathrow. It's one of the longest continuous flights in the world, and I can attest to that. It's a long time in that thin metal tube, especially when you're back in cattle class, but actually it's not that bad. It's dark all the way, so if you can bowl over a couple of hours of shut-eye along the way, you feel half alive when you lob into London early in the morning. What did I listen to on the plane? Well, highlights of last year's Hagerty Radio Le Mans coverage, obviously. I particularly enjoyed the Hyperpole session, which is, for someone who grew up with top 10 shootouts at Bathurst, always pretty special. I used that to get myself up to speed with what happened last year and what to expect this year. After that, I needed to turn the brain off a little bit, so it was the John Wick movies, back to back to back. I've saved the new one for the flight home. I loved them. Somehow, I'd not seen them, so this was a great opportunity to catch up. Arriving in the UK, Heathrow is blessedly deserted at 4:30 in the morning, and within 15 minutes, I'm outside of the airport already and waiting for my Uber, which comes in the form of John Hindhoff in a brilliant dark blue Porsche 911 GTS. Lovely ride. 5-star Uber rating for sure. From there, it's off to Radio Le Mans HQ for a couple of days before making the journey to France. We take a Porsche Cayenne hybrid borrowed from Porsche Cars GB, and it's through the channel on the train, which is a unique experience, and into beautiful bucolic France. My first time here, as I said earlier. France is lovely. I love the paysage, the auto routes, which are well signposted, smooth surface, incredible roads, and a very decent 130 km/h speed limit. It's decidedly unofficious, which is remarkable, and it makes the drive down to this part of the world from the coast particularly excellent. Taking out the 2 days spent in the UK acclimatising to being 10 hours in the past, the trip from my front door to the gate at the circuit itself times out at about 30 hours. Ironically, it's not that much longer than the race itself. Early impressions, well, of course, probably worth the effort. I've got to say, I loved Le Passage, the scrutineering in town on Friday and Saturday. Aside from trying to restrain myself from spending €1 million I don't have on every iconic Le Mans winner in 1/43rd scale at one of the many vendors lining the town square in the centre of the beautiful city of Le Mans, there was a lot to take in. The best thing I loved about it was that it's all geared towards the fans. Their access is superb. Whether it's the question and answer sessions in English and French, the ability to see the entire sequence of technical checks, or the access granted as drivers pose for selfies, sign autographs on their way in and out, and generally say hello. It's as forward-facing a fan event that I've been fortunate enough to experience at an event of this magnitude. The atmosphere is celebratory as well, especially under the beautiful blue skies and warm conditions we were blessed with this year. I found it fascinating that had one of the cars failed scrutineering, the probably 5,000 people in the middle of Le Mans who would have seen it unfold live. That's just access you can't buy anywhere else in the world. The thing that got me, though, was how much this is a motor racing town. I've been lucky in my life to go to lots of great racing cities in the sport. Bathurst, of course, is my second home, but I've been to Daytona for the 500, to Indianapolis for their IndyCar race, and to Sebring. And they're all places that are on the map, on our map, because of their race. They are intrinsically linked to their major sporting event that defines their place. And it would be fair to say that not many people would go to Bathurst if there wasn't a famous racetrack there. And the same could be said for Daytona Beach, for Indianapolis, and for Sebring, and of course, Le Mans. As a result, the people in those towns embrace it totally, without question, wholeheartedly at every moment. You can see it in the shop fronts and the way they're decorated. You can hear it in people's voices. You can see it in the branding throughout from the moment you reach the city limits of each town. Truthfully, I expected Le Mans to be the same because a race like this doesn't last for a century without having that kind of an impact on the local surrounds, and I wasn't disappointed. Like Indianapolis, like Daytona, and like my beloved Bathurst, this is a motorsport city, fiercely proud at having one of the world's most iconic races, and so it should be. My first look at this place was as we drove in on Thursday afternoon, in the week well before the test day. It was a stunning, warm day, as they have all been so far this week, and the weather reminded me of home. We drove through the entry at Tête Rouge, with the extent of Mulsanne Strait disappearing off into the distance, into the heat haze between the forest. It's one of those evocative racetrack arrivals that you don't quickly forget. For me, it was like seeing that Mount Panorama sign on the distance as you drive in, or the high banks of Daytona as you run along Daytona Beach and see it off in the distance. Arriving where we did was significant personally because of what happened at that corner in 2013. Alan Simonson was a mate. He was a friend of mine, with his career perhaps more well-known in Australia than in other parts of the world, including his home of Denmark. Al came to Australia as a young international gun, a hired gun, and made himself extremely popular at home for several reasons. One was because he was blindingly fast. Two, because he was blindingly brilliant outside the car. Al shared the Aussie sense of humour, that colloquialism and that love of life that those of us who knew him have, and there were many of us, not just me, who called him a mate. He was always giving with his time, he was always friendly, he loved a joke, but anything beyond that, he loved driving a racing car fast, and he was so good at it. Alan's raw, electrifying speed was something to behold. And it was cruel for mine that he never had the chance to excel in a full-time drive in our own Supercars Championship, because I've got no doubt he would have been at the front of the field, possibly the best international to race one of our unique Aussie beasts. His drive in the rain at the end of the 2007 Bathurst 1000 will remain with me forever. Driving for 888 Racing, he picked off superstar after superstar and hauled his car. He was sharing with Richard Lyons, another Le Mans great, into the top five at the end. It was extraordinary. I remember vividly the morning we learned that Alan had died in that shocking crash at Tête Rouge in 2013, his Aston slamming into the trees on driver's left. It was early morning in Australia, and we were on at a race meeting at Winton Raceway, another country circuit near another town whose identity is based entirely on the nearby circuit. It was tragic, of course. It was sad, it was heartbreaking, and it was shocking to wake up to that news on the other side of the world. But we knew that instantly we needed to recognise our great mate. And by the end of that day, we, organisers of the Bathurst 12 Hour, had put plans in place to honour Alan by naming the Pole Award trophy after our great Danish mate. It seemed the most appropriate thing, given the commitment required, the bravado, the energy, the exuberance that you need to qualify on pole at Bathurst. All of that summed up Alan Simonson. So arriving at Tête Rouge, seeing his name scrawled in the fading ink and on the thick rubber lining of the tyre bundles that line the wall there, a wall that's now pulled out from the trees that line the circuit on driver's left, was a moment for sure. Remarkable that I could be here 10 years after we lost our great mate to remember that in my own little way. It's nice to come back and see that and experience, and it makes probably the most personal of my own connections to this race. Before I finish this little missive here on Hagerty Radio Le Mans, I need to offer a word for the sports car racing fans and media. I've only been here a minute, not long enough to stuff anything up yet, but the embrace from everyone I've talked to has been superb. I'm lucky to have had the Bathurst 12 Hour as a significant part of my life, and through there I've built relationships within the endurance racing community. I was going to say industry, but it's not. It's a community. And it's generated me many personal friendships that I truly appreciate over the journey, including the team here on Hagerty Radio Le Mans. But what's amazing to me was their outright joy, their outright delight at me being able to be here and experience this event in the centenary. That's really special. In town at Le Passage, I finally met Jim Roller, a friend of Hagerty Radio Le Mans and someone who I'm sure you know. He's a guy I've known for years, but our paths have never crossed in person. There was little doubt Jim and I would get on immediately, of course, but when he told me that Adelaide's Race of 1,000 Years, the turn of the millennium, was one of his most favourite events ever, well, that was instant mateship. John DeGeese, Dan Lloyd from Sportscar 365, Graham Goodwin, Stephen Kilby from Daily Sportscar, and the media that cover this circus and that I've been fortunate to welcome in Bathurst over the years, to a T, they've reciprocated that and tenfold. It's so cool to see that reception, and I truly appreciate it. And then there's the fans. They might know me from my Bathurst waffling or my occasional bleary-eyed appearance on Midweek Motorsport on RS1, or even if they have no idea. I don't even have an idea who I am. But to a T, the sports car fans have been nothing but welcoming. Now, that may change after 24 hours or so of me waffling on Saturday and Sunday, but for now, it's great. Finally, here's my top 10 thoughts about the Le Mans trip so far. I'm a bloke, I love a list, so let's keep it simple. In number 10, it's the French countryside. It is stunning. This place has exceeded my expectations in its beauty and its scenery and its welcome. Fantastic. At number 9, as I mentioned earlier, it's those French Payage auto routes. Stunning road surfaces, fast flowing, good speed limit, and just excellent. And I particularly like the tourism markers, like when we drove past Camembert. It made me hungry, yes, I do love a good cheese. But the sign with the two Porsche 956s as you drive into Department 72 and head towards Le Mans is even more special. At number 8, it's our new friends at United Autosport. We're using their catering this weekend, and it's nothing short of sensational. The hospitality of Yorkshire people is renowned, and I can vouch for that. So can my waistline, which is already large and will go home even larger, thanks to the incredible product that they're providing in their incredible hospitality suite up towards the pit exit end of the pit lane. Thanks to the team, the crew, the chefs, and everyone at United, Richard Dean down, who have been so welcoming so far to us, and thanks for keeping us fed. And if an army marches on its stomach, I'm expecting massive things from United Autosport this week. In number 7, it's the paddock area. It's crammed full. There is not a space to be found for anything other than perhaps an errant Michelin or a Goodyear. It is buzzing. There are people everywhere. The backs of the garages are full. There are bouncers on the bigger teams making sure that no one sneaks in to try and grab an autograph from an Earl Bamba or, more particularly, a Jimmy Johnson or a Jenson Button. And even on the test day, there was a line of people waiting to get hold of the NASCAR heroes up in Garage 56. More on that a little bit later. At 6, it's the little town of Changé where we're staying, not far from the circuit. The lovely Mina and Patrick Toitan, whose hospitality has been superb. It's exposed my embarrassing lack of French and my appalling Aussie accent while trying to say bonjour every morning. But the cafe is excellent, the bread and jams for breakfast outstanding, the bed comfortable, and the beer at the end of the day even better. To Mina and Patrick, I say thank you, and I hope I can come back in the future. At number 5, simply, it's the history you feel when you drive through the gate and into the track. I've been fortunate enough in my career to go to incredible places like the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And when you drive through the gates there and go under the tunnel, past the massive tower, the pagoda in the middle, you feel the ghosts of that place, of more than a century's year history of racing. And it's exactly the same here. Those iconic images you can place, the pit straight, the building, the ACO headquarters, the Tribune, everything about it reeks of history and tradition. And I love it. I adore it. It's incredible. At number 4, and we've only seen a little bit of it so far, but it's the Garage 56 NASCAR. It's everything a guest car should be in this race, even if it does mean there'll be no sleep on Saturday or Sunday for anyone within 100 km of this place. It is loud, it's obnoxious, but it's fantastic, and their complete embrace of this event is something to behold. I love that car. It's right up my alley, and I cannot wait to see how it goes in the race on Sunday. 3, finally seeing cars on track for the first time. It's a long time in the making and well worth the wait. If you caught our test day coverage here on Hagerty Radio Le Mans, you'll know in the second session I wandered up with our radio mic to the exit of Turn 1. I could see the Dunlop Bridge evocatively and the road disappearing beneath the bridge down the hill towards the Forest Esses and then into Tête Rouge. It was an awesome place to watch. The Camaro through at speed, loud, almost deafening. And then the Cadillacs with their statico gunshot downshift, bang, 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 on the downshifts as they break to turn into the first part of the Dunlop chicane. The turbocharged cars with their whoosh and whistle as they go through at speed. The howl of the Porsche 911 RSR, which will be one of the cars I think most people miss with the disappearance of LMGTE. The Corvette, sounds incredible. But just the sights, the sounds, the speed, the hypercars dodging slower cars, and everything about it made it very, very special. And of course, within 5 minutes of standing there, I bumped into another Aussie. G'day to Chris Poynter, who was good enough to come and say g'day. 2, for me, it's the expectation of what's ahead. The best Le Mans field in years. A hypercar battle potentially for the ages. Porsche versus Ferrari versus the dominant Toyotas, with Cadillac and Peugeot there, and then Glickenhaus and even the Van Wall in the mix from a privateer point of view. There's so many stories. The LMP2 war is going to be furious. And then the swan song for GTE, where Porsche and Ferrari and Corvette, of course, a brand with so much success and so much history there. That's going to be special. At 1.5, and I've snuck an extra one in here, it's the surprise of the week for mine in LeBron James being announced as the event ambassador. Now, I know some people won't like that, and I understand, because there are so many people that could have been drawn on from the long history of this place to be the Grand Marshal and to wave that starter's flag at just after 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. But as an event promoter, I get it, totally. And what they've done is just assured that this race, the biggest Le Mans ever, is probably now going to have the biggest amount of coverage in the United States it's ever had, because one of the biggest sporting stars in that place will be here to see the field off. Yes, it's about the celebration of the history. That's important, and I think they've done a wonderful job. I don't mind the fact they've got LeBron to wave the green, because it just builds this event to become even more of an international spectacle, to open it to more eyeballs that might never have seen this race before. That's important. If this race is the entry point for someone into the Le Mans 24 hour, that's only a good thing. And if LeBron does that, it's even better. And at number 1 in my top 10 things of Le Mans so far in my brief time here, before a car even turns a lap, it's just Le Mans. It's everything I'd expected, I'd anticipated, and I can't wait to see more when we go racing and finally get cars on track on Wednesday. So there you go. That's my takeout on this incredible place and what is already, before we've even had a racing lap, this incredible race. I'm Richard Crail. Thanks for listening to the story of my first time here at the Le Mans 24 Hour, with some Aussie history thrown in here on Hagerty Radio Le Mans. Enjoy the week.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.